Anybody have any thoughts about what you'd like to hear us talk about this morning?
About
virtue. Virtue, yes. that's a very good thing to talk about, yes. Virtue in this Dharma is, excuse me, is a practice in itself, and it's not always properly understood. It's very often seen as a set of rules to follow, you know, thou shalt not, right? Don't cause harm to other beings, don't lie, don't use harsh speech or false speech or so forth. But it has a much, much deeper intention and a much greater value than that. What are provided are some guidelines, but what makes one thing virtuous and another thing non-virtuous? This is where we really want to start. This is the question that you need to ask yourself. And you know, it's obvious that to most human beings, at least, that killing other people is not a good thing to do, for example. It's less obvious, and only to a much smaller number of beings, that human beings, that speaking things that are not true is a wrong thing to do. But it kind of leaves unanswered the question, well, what is it exactly about killing or lying or any of these other things that makes them bad? And their opposites, helping another person, telling the truth, protecting others' property that makes them good. And we intuitively know the answer, but it's interesting. The books that have been written and the academic studies departments and universities filled with highly paid faculty and graduate students and so on and so forth that try to figure out rationally and intellectually what is the meaning and significance of these notions of good and bad that we carry, because obviously in different cultures they're not interpreted exactly the same way. There's a lot of variation from one person to another. So we look for a moral principle. Traditionally, for most of our recorded history, the source of such determination has been some divine dictum. You know, God says, thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that. A god or gods or so on and so forth. And one of the things that I find fascinating is the different approach that the Buddha took to this. He when he looked for the answers, he was very pragmatic. He looked at the world as it is and he looked inside. And he saw that all sentient beings experience pleasure and pain. And of course, he wasn't the only one that saw this. And there was a recognition, basically, that just as I wish to experience pleasure and avoid pain, so do all other beings wish to experience pleasure and avoid pain. So we're all the same in this way. And he looked at the world. There were some people who interpreted that in extreme form, that it was really important to do your absolute best to not cause any kind of pain, suffering, harm of any kind. And of course, the logical conclusion, the only way you can do that is to bring about the cessation of your own existence as rapidly and non-disruptively as possible. So what he acknowledged about the nature of the world we live in and the kind of beings we are is that it is impossible for us to live without causing a certain degree of harm, pain, and suffering to other beings. It's just, you know, it's just the way the game is rigged. Life lives on life, and so on and so forth. But he could see a very clear distinction between pain and suffering that could be avoided and that which was an inevitable part of living in this world. And so this is where the moral principle comes from, is ahimsa is avoiding harm. It was a much older term and a much older idea. And he merely clarified it and said, okay, what we're really talking about is avoiding, is not causing harm that can be avoided. It's pretty clear cut. And this makes sense. This is something that we know for ourselves, that there's a lot of suffering involved in going to be involved in our lives, and that there's nothing we nor anybody else in the world could do to avoid it. But at the same time, we know that we have and we will continue to experience suffering that is due to causes that aren't really necessary, right? So this gives us a principle to work by. Now, so virtue can be summed up as doing whatever you can to avoid causing unnecessary harm. Sometimes the doctor has to cause some pain to bring about a greater good. Sometimes we mean to do well, but it produces an unexpected result. We have to take these things into account. We have to accept that we don't have the ability to fully predict the results of all of our actions. We have to accept the fact that no pain, no gain, things like that. But within all of that, within the whole context, within a very realistic and pragmatic context, we can see that we can take our actions and our speech and we can identify them as being good or bad, wholesome or unwholesome, whatever pair of terms you want to use, based on the consequences they have. Do they produce a net increase in suffering in the world that wasn't necessary? Then they're bad. And the opposite is true too. Anything that we can do to reduce the unnecessary suffering, anything we can do to ease the pain of someone else or prevent harm coming from someone else, that is not unavoidable for some reason, then to do that would be to do something that's good. So we have a good solid basis for what is virtuous and what is not, what is good and what is bad. I should state that. We have a good solid basis for good and bad, moral and immoral, so on and so forth like that. Now virtue, I won't get into it, but there's morality and there's ethics and there's virtue. And virtue is something that's practiced for its own sake. So now we go to a different part of the Dhamma teaching. And this is how you practice virtue for its own sake, and how, and the benefit that it has on you by changing the way you are. And here we switch the emphasis from the consequences of your actions to the intentions behind your actions. Okay? Now, the practice of virtue is to act with virtue, with intentions that are wholesome. So the intentions behind your thought and your speech would be to not unnecessarily cause harm, and if possible, to reduce unnecessary harm. Simple as that. And this is stated in things like your right speech, right action, right livelihood. But the thing is that now that we're talking about intention, we can go beyond just the actions in the world, just the speech and behaviors. And we can look internally at the thoughts and emotions. So when we fill our mind with hateful thoughts, or if we fill our mind with loving thoughts, that too can be interpreted on the basis of this same principle. When we allow ourselves to dwell in negative emotions, or when we dwell in positive emotions, the same thing. So our thoughts and emotions also can be judged in terms of the harm that they cause or the good that they do. But the interesting thing is that who do your thoughts and emotions affect if you never act on them? It's you that they affect. When you hold negative thoughts and emotions, they affect you internally, not just in the short term, but long term. In fact, they mold and shape who you are. The more time you spend dwelling in negative thoughts and emotions, you change yourself to be a person who is more prone to have those kinds of thoughts and emotions in the future, right? And I think we know that. Same thing is true of our behavior. If because of our desires we take things that don't belong to us, or if because of our desires we say things that are not true, if because of our dislike and aversion for something we destroy animals, people, things, if because of our aversions we lie or speak harshly, or engage in divisive speech, setting one person against another. The intentions behind these are affecting us, and they're changing who we are. So the practice of virtue, although it's based on a really solid principle, wholesomeness is anything that decreases unnecessary suffering, unwholesomeness is anything that increases it. We can also turn that inward, and now we have a practice, which the way we could describe this practice is that if we practice uh, uh, right right speech, right action, and right livelihood, what we're doing is we are not acting out of desire and aversion. We're forming an intention inside. The inclination arises to do or say something, or even to think or feel something that is unvirtuous. And if we refrain from that, we're conditioning ourselves. And if we do that often enough, after a while, those inclinations weaken and begin to fade away. We begin to free ourselves from craving. Deeper than that, all of this is coming from selfishness. And all selfishness comes from the belief that we are a separate self in a world of others. And that basically we're in competition with everything and everybody else for our happiness and to avoid our suffering. So we're reinforcing that set of beliefs when we behave in non-virtuous ways, and we're undermining our attachment to those beliefs when we do their opposite. So this relates directly to the purpose of the Dharma in the first place. The purpose of the Dharma in the first place is to completely free ourselves, to become awakened, to achieve wisdom. And the essence of wisdom is realizing that we are not a separate self, that everything is interconnected, that our suffering and the suffering that we cause others is due to our craving, and craving comes from selfishness. So that the practice of virtue now becomes a way of transforming ourselves, and it's a way of transforming ourselves which will lead to awakening. Every time we deny the selfish impulse, we weaken the hold that the belief has on us that we are a separate self. If we combine that with meditation practice and Dharma study, we will come to the point where we no longer experience ourselves as suffering. Likewise, by intentionally denying the cravings that arise, which would cause us to act out of desire or aversion, we loosen the power that they have over us. And as they begin to weaken, and as they eventually disappear, you know, once we stop seeing ourselves as a separate self, there's no reason for craving anymore. We're a part of a much greater whole. And we see ourselves in the same light that we see any other person. So we have no reason to cause harm to another person in order to benefit ourselves, because we see, you know, it's like the attitude that, it's the attitude of love. When you love another person, your partner, your parent, your children, whatever, then you want the good for them as much as you do yourself, and you want to prevent harm for them as much as you do yourself. And so now your actions are no longer selfishly based. With the elimination of craving comes the elimination of our own suffering and of our causes for other people's suffering. So in this Dharma, the practice of virtue is actually a path to awakening. As a matter of fact, one of the things that we say each morning is virtue is the vehicle for liberation. Practicing virtue, overcoming craving and attachment to self, is how we become awakened or enlightened, whichever term you prefer to use. Not necessarily by itself, but certainly in combination with meditation and with studying and understanding the Dharma, then virtue is the vehicle for liberation, the practice of virtue. So, and it's and I love the way that it is based on a principle that is it's not theoretical. It's not abstract. It's not dependent upon anything supernatural. And it corresponds exactly with a sense that I think all human beings are born with. That causing harm to others. We don't want harm caused to ourselves. Causing harm to others is not good. We want pleasure, and allowing other people to experience pleasure is a good thing. So it's consistent with our own instincts and intuitions. It's completely rational. It is not dependent upon anything outside of our own real-life experience to make sense of. That's the way I see it, the way I find it. It's practical, but it's also challenging, because most of us, we have a lifetime experience of not behaving in that way. And it's very hard to change those patterns of behavior. And you can get up every morning with the intention to behave virtuously during the day. And at the end of the day, you'll reflect and find that over and over again, you've failed to do that. And this is where the other parts of the Dharma come into it. I mean, virtue, you know, if you're presented with nothing but virtue, which is one third of the Eightfold Path, you'd look at it and say, wow, that's great, that makes sense. But then you try to do it and you run into these huge obstacles. That's right, the Eightfold Path in its entirety, it is a system that does work and has worked countless times for countless people.
So if one is
can I pass this to you, because otherwise when we record this nobody's ever going to hear what you say. Oh, it's got a dead battery. Let me change that first too. Sorry for the delay. Because I'm eagerly awaiting what you have to say.
Thank you. So this craving, I wonder about consciously objectifying someone or something, and then what about if it's unconscious? You're unconsciously objectifying. You have no awareness. Maybe you have a little inkling, or maybe really it's so patterned that you haven't brought consciousness to it. It's an unconscious objectification of of another person, and which may cause harm to oneself and yourself.
Yes, and we do this all of the time. You can leave that turned on so we can pass it around. And I mean, the fact is our conscious mind is just a tiny part of our mind, and the vast majority of our behavior is driven by unconscious processes. Yet, what are you? I mean, other than your consciousness, and other than knowing that there's this huge unconscious part of your mind that is determining so much, the only thing you have to work with is what arises in consciousness. So, first of all, you've got to recognize that the problem lies deeply buried. Here we get Freudian, right? All the difficulties, all the problems, they're hidden in the unconscious, where we can't get at them, we can't see them, we don't even know they're there for the most part. All we know is what becomes conscious. So, knowing that, then we want to cultivate our consciousness to the highest degree. Because what's going on in our unconscious does, to some degree, in bits and pieces here and there. It does come into consciousness in different forms. And we want to become more fully conscious so that we know when that happens. And this tells us what's going on at an unconscious level. The other thing, though, is that we are conscious of the words that come out of our mouth. We are conscious of the effects that we have. We're conscious of the actions we engage in and the effects that we have. And we're most definitely conscious of the thoughts that we think and the emotions that arise. So even though the true cause of all of these is the unconscious, we do become conscious of them, you know, through their manifestation. And so the only thing we have to work with is our consciousness, and therefore to become more fully conscious is the most important and valuable thing that we can do, so that we can apply that consciousness and use it. And that's what the term mindfulness is referring to, is becoming more fully conscious in this way, so that we learn to observe ourselves and we hear what we're saying to somebody else. And if we're conscious enough, we're also aware of the emotions behind our saying that. You know, even the hidden and dishonest and distorted ones, you know. I'm only telling you this for your own good, because, you know, being more fully conscious allows you, it puts you much more in contact with the reality of your unconscious conditioning, which really is driving your behavior. And once it does that, it also gives you the opportunity to choose at the very least, to choose not to perform an action or not to say something you're about to say. But as your skills in this increase, it gives you the opportunity to do or say something different. It even goes beyond that. When you find yourself dwelling in negative thoughts and emotions, it gives you the choice, and this does take some skill to do, but it gives you the choice to intentionally think different thoughts and intentionally steer your mind towards a different emotional state. And you'll get better and better at this over time. The other thing is that everything that happens in consciousness affects the unconscious. So there's this unconscious part of your mind that causes you to behave in this particular way every time you find yourself in this particular situation. Or if we take your example, okay, there's some unconscious part of your mind that is causing you to objectify a particular person in a particular way that is unwholesome. When you become conscious that you're doing that, you can also become conscious of the fact that every time you let that happen, you're reinforcing that and you're making that more, you're causing that to happen more and more, so that you can actually become, you can actually start working with it. If you can hold in consciousness the negative consequences, both to both yourself and to the other person, of that objectification, if you can see how it's harming you, and if you see how in many subtle ways it's harming that person, it's not only harming that person, but it's also harming other people that you may similarly objectify. Holding that information in consciousness feeds that information directly into the unconscious part of your mind that's responsible for that objectification in the first place. Now, every unconscious part of your mind has the same prime directive, and that's to make the whole of me be well and happy. The well-being and happiness of the whole of me is really the objective of all these unconscious parts of our mind. So the one that's causing this objectification or this other behavior to happen, as it starts to get feedback, and the only feedback it can get is what you hold in consciousness, right? So if you ignore, brush aside, overlook, rationalize away, it doesn't get any feedback. But if you stop doing that and you look directly at what's happening, now this unconscious part of your mind, it's getting feedback. It says, hey, and what it says to itself is, oh, this isn't really contributing to the well-being and happiness of myself. And so it reprograms itself. You can't do anything. You can't even know really what's going on in your unconscious except through what its conscious manifestations. And there's absolutely no way you can change the way the unconscious parts of your mind work through any act of will, but by providing the feedback, those unconscious parts of your mind will reprogram themselves.
So binging on chocolate wouldn't be the best choice to to push away the unconscious when it shows up?
Well, you know, everything is relative. It depends on what you might have done otherwise had you not binged on chocolate. Once you overcome the tendency to do whatever it is that might be much worse than that, then you can work on the binging on chocolate. Yeah. Tim wanted to say something. So.
No, it's okay. Oh. We're just spitting into the...
It won't get recorded if you don't...
Yeah. Would you work the present moment into this? Living in the present moment?
Yes, the present moment is where this happens. It's where all of this happens. Now, that's when we are thinking about the past or when we are planning future. If you are rehashing in your mind an argument you just had with somebody, the rehash is happening in the present. Everything's happening in the present. When you're thinking about what I'm going to say to so-and-so next time I see them, that thought is happening in the present. Everything is happening in the present. Both the past and the future are just stories that we tell ourselves in the present. And it's really important to realize that. Because until you realize that, you're not going to be quite as capable of truly working with the present. You're saying, okay, my mind, my unconscious mind is projecting these thoughts of what happened earlier today, and associated with that is a strong emotion, and that's what you have to work with. I think it's very important, a very important part of this is that you learn to see what's happening in your mind objectively. Because the problem is we identify with it. I'm angry, or I'm this, or I'm that. And as soon as we do that, we lose the ability to see what's happening in the present. Because what's happening is in the present isn't that some I is angry or fearful or obsessed or whatever. It's that anger or fear or obsession are arising, and that's what you want to see. You want to see you want to be in that objective place. So now you're in the present. Okay, in this present moment, this process is taking place. And I can see that this process is taking place, and I can understand somewhat why it's taking place, and I can make choices about to what degree I'm willing to, and it's desirable for me to allow this to continue. It creates being in the present, and having that objective perspective creates choices. Otherwise, we say to ourselves, I'm angry, and because angry is what I am, I can't change that. But when anger is something that's arising, it is something that you can change. It's something that you can view objectively. Even if you don't change the anger, even if you observe it objectively and say, oh, look at how this feeling of anger makes me feel bad, makes my body feel bad. Look at how it's going to spoil the rest of my afternoon, and so on and so forth. Now you're giving the feedback to the unconscious mind that is going to help allow that anger to go away. So you can reach a level of skill where it's called thought replacement. You replace your negative thoughts with positive thoughts. But a long time before that, you can just observe objectively. And when you observe it objectively, you see that it's not a good thing, and you see that you'd be better off without it. And then the part of your mind that's causing it to happen becomes much more willing to stop making it happen.
If you got really, really, really good at living in the present moment, how much effect is the unconscious having?
Well, the unconscious is always, well, let's put it this way. Absolutely everything that appears in your consciousness in the present moment comes from your unconscious.
Okay, but if I'm living in the present moment, who cares about my unconscious?
Well, you do, because everything internally that's happening in this present moment is the result of the activity of your unconscious. See, if you're living in the present moment,
let me ask this a different way.
Yeah, ask it a different way.
Is the unconscious a fixed size?
Is it a fixed size?
Yeah.
No. As a matter of fact, it's as big as the whole universe of mind. Which...
Wait.
Yeah, okay.
Can more and more and more of the unconscious become conscious?
Yes, it can, and it does. But if you're asking, could you ever become completely conscious of everything that's in the unconscious? The answer to that is no. The consciousness is. Consciousness is this wonderful part of our mind that we have to work with, but it is limited, and I'll convey its limitation in two different ways. People who study consciousness in terms of information theory find that the ordinary human being is receiving billions of bits of information just through their senses in every moment, in every second, billions of bits of information per second. And nobody's determined yet exactly what the contents of consciousness are in a second, but it's at the absolute max, it's of the order of a few hundred bits, and that's only from your senses. So then you have all the parts of your unconscious mind that are purely mental in nature. And now we're talking about the mind of one person, somebody who becomes a subject in a laboratory, and they're just trying to estimate what is the capacity of consciousness. The capacity of consciousness compared to the unconsciousness is a few hundred at most, and possibly less. compared to billions. And then the other thing that I said, the size of your unconscious is the size of all that we call mind in the universe. Because the separation of our individual minds is an illusion. I mean, the function of an individual mind is to create, is to artificially isolate itself so that a person can function. Because if you couldn't separate the information that's relevant to that particular body and your bank account and your housekeeping needs and your eating and healthcare and so forth, if you couldn't isolate that from the information in all the other minds, then you wouldn't last long. So this is what an individual mind does, is artificially isolates itself from the much greater whole that it's a part of. And Carl Jung realized this, and he actually described it as the collective unconscious. And I think the truth of the collective unconscious goes farther than Carl Jung ever dreamed. It's that everything, just as everything on the physical level is interconnected, so is everything on the psychic level totally interconnected. And there is no way that your itty-bitty consciousness is ever going to encompass the totality of that. I mean, that would be essentially to know the mind of God. It would be the totality of not just the consciousness of all human beings, but the consciousness of all sentient beings anywhere, including other galaxies. You're not really separate from those. When you realize that, one of the implications it has is that it takes your thoughts and emotions out of the completely private sphere. Your thoughts and emotions actually, they have implications that ramify out. Just they drop a pebble in the surface of a pond, and the ripples, you know, just they get smaller and smaller, but they go on forever. And if you take any action in the world, you can never really predict what its ultimate consequences are going to be. And the same thing is your thoughts and your emotions and your mental states and the character traits that you cultivate. If you cultivate loving kindness, that loving kindness goes far beyond you. And your thoughts your mental states and the character traits that you develop, they have consequences that could be manifesting on the other side of the physical universe, for all you know. Because you simply cannot have access to that information. We are a part of something much, much greater, so much greater than anything that we could ever conceive. It's just, our imaginations are useless in the face of it. And it's actually the realization of that that is in a major way responsible for the liberation that we're seeking by undergoing this process.
I'm concerned.
Yes?
Because if I'm trying to live in the present moment, let me ask this. Where does habit and beliefs and lie? Where, in the unconscious or conscious? Or both?
Where do you think they lie? What's your best guess?
I think they lie in the unconscious.
I agree totally, yeah.
Okay. But I also believe that practicing living in the present moment is a way of addressing those habits, because you learn to see them as they arise.
Absolutely, yes. That's you're saying it. That's what I was trying to say a few minutes ago. You just put it more succinctly and clearly. Thank you.
No, I'm not so concerned anymore.
Yep.
Because that means that I can practice and develop another habit pattern that allows me to address the unconscious behavior as it arises.
Exactly. That is the wonderful thing that this is telling you, is that I can change myself. It doesn't matter what habits that I have, and it doesn't matter what beliefs that I have. They're all subject to change, and I have the power to change them through what I do consciously in the present moment.
I got asked a very interesting question the other day. It took me all day to come up with the answer. And that was that if change, if we don't do anything,
yeah,
things tend to stay the same. If we don't make any efforts to change, things stay the same based on these unconscious habits and beliefs. Okay? And then somebody asked me, he says, well, what about the constant, the fact that change is the constant? And I couldn't give a good answer to that until the next day. And that was that, yes, the changes are constant through life. Our yeah. response to them tends to stay the same. Yeah. And that's coming from the unconscious and way that we've constructed yeah. our, and I'm assuming that we actually construct our own unconscious.
Yeah. We construct our own unconscious through what we consciously allow to happen. When the same habitual response occurs over and over again, and every time we go with it, it becomes reinforced. But the thing is, absolutely everything does change. First of all, the difference that we're talking about is whether we are using conscious intention to direct the way we change, or whether we're just letting it happen haphazard by accident. The uninformed person becomes who they are as a result of accident. Things happen to you. You were in different situations. You reacted in different ways, and through your reactions, you became the person you are. Somebody else might have had exactly those same things happen to them and become a different person because they responded to those events in a different way. But what we all have in common is until we understand how this works, it's all kind of happening by accident with no intention behind it all. The wonderful thing is, once we understand how it works, now we can direct which way. We're not just drifting into who we are. But a person who has a set of habits and beliefs that they just continue every time those habits manifest, and every time those beliefs become conscious, they just go with them. They are changing. They're making them stronger. So everything changes and nothing stays the same. And even so, I mean, people are concerned with, you know, they have a bad habit that started in their 20s and now they're in their 40s and they still have the same bad habit. But it's not that nothing's changed. It's that they've allowed it to become reinforced and become stronger and stronger. And other things have changed. Because of that bad habit, there's other habits that they've developed. And because of that bad habit, there's other beliefs that they've developed in order to rationalize not doing anything about that bad habit, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of change taking place. They're just focusing on one little part of it and assuming that nothing has changed. But the whole thing is to realize is that we have the power to change all of these things. And that if we've become what we are through accident, through just following our impulses, then the time has come when we understand how this works, to then begin to direct the person that we're going direct the process of change that's going to determine the person we are in the future.
Or the whole society.
And through that, it's going to affect the people around you, eventually to some degree, the whole society. And here we get a bit mystical and stuff like that. But if enough of us change, we can change the universe. Just as if enough of us change, we can change what happens in society. If enough of us change the way we use our minds, our sentience, and this is expressed in the Mahayana, and the idea that ultimately all sentient beings will become fully awakened Buddhas, that's our ultimate destination. And each mind that awakens moves the whole one step farther in that direction. So to be a bodhisattva is to contribute through your own awakening to the ultimate awakening of all sentient beings.
Can I ask one more?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I then, hate to and get then off Beatrice. The subject. All right.
As long more. As it doesn't change
it's
the subject.
No, it's quick.
Okay.
How young do you think the self-aware, the ability to recognize unconscious behavior occurs?
My guess is probably around, with the proper training, it's probably around 3 or 4 years of age. That's just
really?
My off-the-cuff guess. But most people don't ever discover this until they're decades into their life, if ever. Most people never discover it at all. But let Beatrice have a shot at it.
My question is somewhat related to the conversation, but not entirely.
Thank you. My question is somewhat related to the conversation, but not entirely. I'm curious to hear what you say about the difference between this idea of selflessness that is at the core of
yes.
Buddhism and personality. Because mm-hmm. you know there are certain characteristics that people, I feel, are born with.
Yes,
you know,
they are.
And that they remain.
Yes.
To a great degree,
yes.
throughout their lives. So how does that gel mm-hmm. with the idea of selflessness?
Okay. This is wonderful question and one that we could speak about at very great length. So I'm going to have to speak about this separately. But first of all, what was really clear to the Buddha, and I think what's really clear to anybody that's practiced the Dharma to the extent of understanding the nature of no self, is that personality and personhood have a reality. They have a relative reality, but they have a reality. They're real. You being a person is totally real. And this is what's confusing to some people, is they feel like when they hear when they read or hear Buddhist teaching, it says that you don't really you're not the self you think you are. There's no self. They think, I'm not a person. Sure I am. And I know what kind of a person I am, and all this other kind of stuff. And yes, that is totally real. What we're saying is that at the core of your personhood isn't some immutable essence, that everything is process and everything is interconnected. And so your personhood is real at a particular level, but it's not real at the level of somewhere in there being a core that is Beatrice. Rather, what you are. The Buddha described a person from the inside, and for whatever reason, if he described a person from the outside, it didn't really come down very clearly. But he described a person from the inside, and if we understand this correctly, we all recognize it and say, oh yeah, right, got it. What am I from the inside? I am consciousness. I am consciousness of sensations, and via these sensations I'm conscious of physicality in general, of the world and of my body. So I am conscious of sensations and therefore of my physical body. I am conscious of my feelings of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Everything I'm conscious of, well, I'm conscious of two kinds of things, mental things and sensations, okay? And whether it's a mental thing or a sensation, associated with it is a feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that's another thing I'm conscious of. And I'm conscious of perceptions. Whenever I see or feel or hear something, my mind takes all its stored information and it generates a perception. So I don't just see colors and lines and shapes. I see people and cars and trees and things like that. And as a matter of fact, it's very difficult for me to see, to actually see colors and shapes. It's just like, I see perceptions. I see recognizable things, right? And same thing with hearing and everything else. So, and then he says, and then there's thoughts and emotions and mental states and ideas and beliefs and everything else. All these other mental formations. So he described a person from the inside as this constantly changing content of consciousness. And he also pointed out that consciousness is not continuous. This is the mistake that a lot of people have made since then. People talk about flow of consciousness. And people talk about a stream of consciousness, and they somehow imagine that they've had the same stream of consciousness their whole life. And that's not true. It's interrupted. And if you think about it and you look at it, you discover that it's constantly interrupted. A new consciousness arises in each experience. So he described what a person was from the inside for the purposes largely of showing that if you examine what you are from the inside, you find there's nothing there that you can label as a self. There's no one part, nor the whole. That everything, that this whole collection of what you think you are from the inside is constantly changing. Now, within that one aggregate of mental formations, that's really the unconscious that we're talking about. There lies the tendencies to always perceive things in certain ways, to generate certain kinds of feelings in response to certain experiences, to pay attention to certain things and ignore other things, and so on and so forth. These are all mental constructs. They are mental constructs that have been built up over the course of a lifetime. And they're what we see from the outside. When I look at you from the outside, I can't know your internal conscious subjective experience, but I assume that you're conscious because you behave like you are. I assume that people are that they have the same kind of internal experience that I do, because they all act as if they do. And we see the same thing with dogs and cats and deer and birds and fish and everything else, that, to different degrees, but we say that thing behaves like it's conscious, right? So we assume that there's that same internal thing, but we can never see it. What we see externally, though, is a collection of traits and characteristics and predispositions. And so we say, oh, okay, you know, Mokasaya, he's what I see is his behaviors, his expressions, and the things that he says. I see, and I see that there's a consistent pattern to it. And that's the person. That's the person that I see in you. You see yourself the same way. You see your own behavior. And you look at yourself and you say, well, in addition to the things that the Buddha described, I see that I always kind of behave in this pattern. There's a pattern to it. There's something that I could describe as me. Now, that's not any more permanent than anything else. That's changing. But there is this thread that runs through it, even as you change. You know, it's the predispositions that you have now that, as they change, determine the kind of change that's going to happen. And that's what a person is. A person is real.
But couldn't you argue that that's the essence of the person?
You could argue that that's the essence of a person, and I'd agree with you. So long as you identify that essence as a constantly changing essence that is being determined by all kinds of other factors, that it isn't any kind of self-existent, self-contained thing, because it's not. It's a constantly changing process. Now, when we're born, we inherit genes. You know, everybody knows this, that you have some traits that we also see in our parents or our grandparents. Sometimes we don't see them at all in our parents, but we're a lot like our grandmother or grandfather or aunts and uncles or whatever. Our genes cause our brain to wire up in a particular way, which is a predisposition to particular kinds of things. Now, let's jump to this other idea that everything is interconnected at the mental level, just as it is at the physical level. So, in a sense, if your genes cause your brain to be wired up in a particular way, you're going to tune in to certain aspects of mentality, right? And so you're not only inheriting tendencies from your physical ancestors, whose genes you carry, you're also inheriting mental predispositions from those who have gone before, right? Think of it as you're like a radio tuner, and you're going to tune in to certain stations and certain frequencies. And these two things are going to mutually reinforce each other. And so they're going to tend to become stronger, and you're going to develop your personality and your characteristics. Which kind of happens by itself, unless we decide to take some conscious, intentional control of it. You know, so somebody born with a certain set of predispositions could become a very angry and unhappy person as a result of this process that we just kind of say, okay, that's who that person is, and we see all these character traits manifest, and if we look inside their mind, we'd see the kinds of perceptions that arise and the feelings that arise and the mental formations that are responsible for it. We can't see that. But that is the essence of that individual's personhood. And it's totally real. It's just it doesn't have this quality of being some single enduring it is rather a product of causes and conditions that's come together, that's made up of many parts, and is constantly changing. And here's the important part. If you happen to be that person who is prone to anger and unhappiness, you can change that. You can change the frequency of the radio and tune into a different station. You can tune into loving kindness instead of anger, and you can turn into joy instead of unhappiness. You can change that. But there, nowhere in this is a self. Okay? Nowhere in this is something. And the thing is that if you, to the degree that your psyche becomes a highly integrated entity in which these different predispositions mutually reinforce each other and fit together really strongly, then they'll continue to, they'll be very strong, they'll be very stable, their stability will last for a long time. As I said earlier, if you become a Buddha or any of the stages of awakening approaching that, that moves all sentient beings closer to being that, because we're all interconnected. Of course, if you become a nasty guy like Hitler or Pol Pot, it has the same effect, right? then that goes forward. And people, individuals will be born in the future whose minds will be predisposed to tune into Hitler and Pol Pot, and others will be predisposed to tune into the various Buddhas and Bodhisattvas over time. But then they have the choice of what they do with that and where they go with that. That will continue on in the future. If you develop a strongly integrated, and here we can use the word integrity, if your personality is one that manifests a high degree of integrity, then that collection of predispositions is going to find a suitable place to settle when your physical form ceases to exist. So there is a sense in which we could say that something is reborn. What the Buddha said is reborn is your karma. And he said your karma is your intentions, and the fruit of your intentions is the kind of person that you become. So that's what we're talking about now, the Bodhisattvas and the Pol Pots, right? Right. And so there never was any self who was Pol Pot. There was never any self that was a Bodhisattva. But the karmic Pol Potness does go forward and does get reborn. And so does the karmic Bodhisattvaness. But what gets reborn is not the self that you think you are or feel you are or believe you are or anything like that. What is reborn is what your karma as intention has created in terms of mental dispositions. And it's the process by which, at least according to the Mahayana, and I believe it, because it, to me, when I look at the history of the universe, it definitely seems progressive and positive. So that's the mechanism by which the life that we create, in a sense, the life that you create between your birth and death exists forever. And it has a huge impact on the future. But there's no self in that. And the good part of that is that whatever you are today, you can change for the good or the bad. and you can change it intentionally, or you can let those changes just happen due to the accidents of fate. So. You're most welcome. And let's stop and take a break, and then we'll come back and meditate together.